This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris Perry, and I want you to go back in time with me to May of 1963. Yeah, Jimmy Soul was singing about happiness as he rose up the Billboard charts, but it belied the mood of a nation in pain.
These are the front lines of the battle between Dr. Martin Luther King's Negro Disciples of Nonviolence and the uniformed forces of Birmingham, led by Commissioner Eugene Bull Connor, who says, "We were trying to be nice to them, but they won't let us be."
The movement to end racial segregation in Georgia had stalled after an unsuccessful effort in Albany. Dr. King was jailed in Birmingham, and the SCLC was having trouble recruiting volunteers for its nonviolent direct action efforts. That was when strategist James Bevel introduced a stunning and difficult idea. Put school-aged children on the front lines of the protests to end Jim Crow. Over 1,000 young people responded to the call for action. They gathered at the 16th Street Baptist Church, and they began marching peacefully in small groups, singing freedom songs. But the Birmingham police, under the direction of the infamous Bull Connor, had no intention of allowing these children to assemble or march. Officers attacked the young people with dogs, batons, and high-powered fire hoses. That night, Americans across the nation were forced to reckon with this racist state violence enacted against children.
Lo and behold, coming off of the steps at the 16th Street Baptist Church, there were 25 to 40, 50 sheriffs across the road with these little batons in their hands at the ready.
First, we were faced with the dogs and the water hose.
And speaking through a megaphone, said, "Get out of this line or you're going to jail." I was so intimidated by facing a white man. I'd never had that encounter.
We were put in a cell block, I understand, holds 650 people. And this cell block had over 1,500 people in it. It was a ferocious thunderstorm that day. And I can recall several of the girls said that God don't even want us.
That sound is from the History Channel special on the Children's Crusade of 1963. And those are the voices of actual participants. They're now adults, but you can still hear the fear, the distress they must have felt facing those officers. Now, when we think about police violence against Black children today, we tend to think of fatal encounters. Like 16-year-old Micaiah Bryant, who was fatally shot by Columbus, Ohio police officer Nicholas Reardon. Or 12-year-old Tamir Rice, gunned down by officers on a Cleveland playground in 2014. And of course, 18-year-old Michael Brown, killed by police in Ferguson, Missouri. But it would be a mistake to imagine that the only harms Black youth endure at the hands of police are fatal. A recent report by the Marshall Project shows that Black children who survive troubling encounters with police are disproportionately likely to be hurt, harmed, and traumatized by the officer's use of force. According to researchers at UC Berkeley, Black girls in California are 4 times more likely to experience excessive force by police than white girls, no matter how young they are. And research shows that officers perceive Black girls to be more adult and less innocent than white girls, no matter how young they are. Now, here's an example you might remember. And listen, we're going to play some sound of children in pain, and we're just warning you so it's not a shock. Although, maybe it needs to be. In June of 2015, an officer was called to a disturbance at a pool party in McKinney, Texas. He pulled a gun on the Black teenagers at the pool and pushed a girl, still in her bikini bathing suit, onto the sidewalk. He forced her head to the ground, sat on her back. It sounds like chaos, right? And that's the context of a lot of these moments. It's tough to hear, but the girl is begging the officer not to touch her. That same year, a school resource officer in Columbia, South Carolina, forcibly ripped a 14-year-old girl from her seat, flipped her desk, and dragged her across the room because she would not give him her cell phone.
I will get your dad.
No, you said that you were going to pepper spray me. No, please, no, stop.
And in February of this year,
just prayer at this point.
A police officer in Rochester, New York, handcuffed and pepper sprayed a 9-year-old girl who was screaming for her father.
I got her.
In 2016, a 15-year-old black girl named Breonna Stewart was riding her bicycle in the predominantly white neighborhood of Hagerstown, Maryland.
Well, I thought it was just a normal day. I was just going to go ride my bike.
I spoke with Breonna and asked her about that day.
I was just, you know, spending time outside riding my bicycle. I was actually going to go meet up with a friend, and he said he was going to be a little late, so I continued to ride around by the area where we were supposed to meet at. It's called Fairgrounds. We were going to play basketball. And in that time that I was waiting on him, I got hit by a vehicle. And everything just kind of changed from that point on in my life.
After determining that she was okay, the driver who hit Breonna called 911. And Breonna wanted to go home. But when the police arrived on the scene, they had no intention of letting her leave. Officers tried to question Breonna, but she was scared. She yelled, she cursed. She tried to get on her bike and ride home, but the police proceeded to pull her off her bike, force her into a police car, and pepper spray her in the face before driving her down to the station and cuffing her to a bench. And remember, this is a 15-year-old child who'd just been hit by a car. Listen.
Okay, so you're going to step back. I'll just spray her.
Put your feet in, you're getting sprayed.
There's a lot of noise here, but you can hear just how frightened and upset she is. You never know from that sound that Breonna was the victim that police had been called to assist.
I feel as though it should have never happened. And yes, I do feel as if they were treating me as if I did something wrong, like as if I was a criminal.
A few days after the incident, Breonna and the police department each spoke publicly about their encounter. And initially, she was not charged with any wrongdoing. But then they changed their tune.
The video that was taken on my cell phone was posted. And from that point forward, they never charged, like they released me the same day and they told my mom that, you know, I wasn't charged with anything, that they just wanted to question me. After the video was posted, my lawyer and us, we had like a little conference meeting. I think that's what it's called, or told my story. I said what happened. And then right after that, the police had their press conference, and the police officers said that they were charging me with all these charges.
Ultimately, Breonna wrote an apology to officers for cursing and kicking. All the charges were dropped. But here's what we want to draw attention to. Breonna suffered more harm at the hands of police officers called to help than from the driver who hit her with a car. Even more troubling is knowing that her experience is not an isolated one. Breonna says what happened to her was inevitable.
From what my parents told me, and what I've seen, you know, I knew not to talk to the police, for one, because I'm a minor. And two, you know, that it's bound to happen. it's just bound to happen because I'm of color.
For more on the use of force against black girls, I spoke with Abby Van Sickle, staff writer for The Marshall Project, a news organization that covers the criminal justice system. Abby reported on Breonna and other black girls facing harm at the hands of authorities.
The trauma of these incidents lasts many years, you know, after the incident. One mother talked about how her daughter now sleeps with a weighted blanket to try to soothe her to sleep. another mother whose daughter had had a police officer sit on her back, said that her daughter wakes up yelling out for, you know, people to get off of her back. You know, parents reported that their kids, you know, became less outgoing, stayed in the house more often. Even those who said that they had trusted police before said that they would no longer trust the police if they were in trouble. And I thought all of those things were really important because they were such a pattern in the interviews that we did.
It's always a bad idea to take journalistic stories personally as a host, as a journalist, but this one really did hit me. My eldest niece was 16 years old when she was arrested on the south side of Chicago for standing in the wrong line at McDonald's. She went to an all black, a large public high school, and the black franchise owner at the McDonald's had created during the lunchtime hour when the high school kids would come in, like basically a separate but equal line where the high school kids were forced to sit, you know, stand in one line and sit in one part of the restaurant. And she stood in the wrong line, the adult line, and was arrested, handcuffed by Chicago police, and transported back to her school in a police wagon vehicle. And she is 32 now, and that trauma is still absolutely on the surface. Like, it, I can't think of a Thanksgiving or a Christmas holiday where she hasn't talked about it with us 16 years later.
A couple of things. One is that we found the experience, you're talking about, you know, something where you are in, quote, the wrong line at a McDonald's, that many of the incidents where families and youths, some now adults, share their stories started with things as minor as that. Some girls in Florida going to a condominium pool and some neighbors thinking that they shouldn't have been able to use the pool. In Brianna's case, a bike accident. Some kids at a trampoline park outside of St. Louis. That, you know, many of the incidents started small and then quickly escalated into something that ended up sticking with those kids, you know, into, you know, in some cases into adulthood. I also had reached out to some experts who train police officers in working with youth and in interacting with them. And one of the things that came up in those interviews is the focus on brain development, that, you know, teenagers, your niece's brain was still developing when that happened, and that those experiences during our middle school and high school years can be so formative and can really stick with us for years. And I think that's something that really did come out in the reporting.
Why does this happen? let's start with why police typically use use of force with anyone, and then particularly why it is happening with minors and then with Black girls.
We were able to get data. We were able to, you know, do a lot of interviews. The why of why it happens to Black girls is something that, you know, we really tried to get at in the journalism. And what I can tell you, you know, from our reporting is that from use of force experts, they talk about how police are many times taught to maintain control of an encounter. So they are taught often that maintaining control is paramount, and also that anyone can be a threat, whether it is, you know, a child or an older person. And so if there's a moment in an encounter where somebody talks back, doesn't immediately do what police are telling them to do, that can be seen as a threat to the control of the situation. And so police, that's oftentimes, even from the videos of these incidents, you can see that that's that moment when somebody talks back, pushes back against the police, that seems like it's when these incidents really escalate into a use of force. And, you know, there's no specific rules, no national rules around when and how police use force against kids and youths. It is one of the factors that they take into account when they're using force, but it's just one of, you know, of many factors.
I know that we have research out of multiple advocacy and academic institutions suggesting that Black children are typically seen as older, more adult than they actually are, and that Black girls in particular are seen as adults when they're still very much children. Is that part of what's happening here?
You know, that's something that came up in the reporting process, that, you know, in Brianna's case, if you have seen any of the video of what happened or met Brianna, she's quite petite. And so the idea that she could be perceived as older than she is, I found to be, you know, a little bit hard to imagine. But that is something that because of her race and because of the way that adults, you know, see Black girls as older, that's something that came up. Kristen Henning, who's a professor at Georgetown Law, you know, has really studied this, as have some other academics at the Georgetown Law Center on Poverty and Inequality. And I call it the adultification of Black youth, that they are perceived as less innocent and older than they are. And so I thought that was really important to get that research into our piece.
Talk to me about potential solutions. Is this something we just have to live with? Or are there ways that either training or awareness or, you know, holding people accountable, officers in particular, can make a difference?
Yeah. So on the training front, I spent a lot of time talking with people who train police officers specifically on interacting with youth. And that I thought was really important work to also get into the piece. Lisa Thoreau is one of the leading experts on this. She has an organization that has trained officers in more than 20 states. And in their trainings, they focus on not only sort of understanding the teenage brain, brain development, the typical behaviors that teenagers exhibit. Like we all know, because we were all teenagers, or we have teenagers, impulsivity, talking back, distrust of authority, that these are all totally normal. And so how do officers figure out how they're going to respond so that they slow down encounters, that they talk to kids in, you know, in language that's appropriate for the kid's age, and also, you know, to ask questions like, how can I help you? How can we work through this? Ways that engage in a positive way, or, you know, to try to de-escalate something rather than, for example, seeing a kid who's clearly in some kind of crisis and saying something like, calm down, which every expert that I talked to said that that actually is like the worst thing you can say, because it just inflames and blows up something rather than what I, you know, is is the goal, which is to slow things down and actually have someone calm down to a point where they can really interact, you know, in a clear way.
So I guess I'm sitting here thinking about this training question. And I guess, I mean, when you are an officer who has arrived on the scene after the EMTs and you are dealing with anyone who has just been in an accident, I guess I'm a little surprised that official training would even be necessary. Like, isn't there, I don't know, common sense about you don't then at any point pepper spray that person, particularly if they're a child?
You know, I talked with Shelley Kutkowski, she's a police officer and a trainer in North Carolina. And we talked for a long time about her experience training younger officers. And she said one of the things that comes up for her a lot are officers who are young, may not have families, you know, don't have a ton of life experience yet. And also, she said she started to see people coming through who don't have a lot of experience or skill set in, you know, interacting person to person with somebody, as opposed to, you know, texting with someone over a device and so she actually spends a lot of time, she said, focusing on just practical common sense ways of interacting with people before going out onto the streets as an officer.
Abby Van Sickle, staff writer for the Marshall Project. It's a news organization covering the criminal justice system. And we also heard from Brianna Stewart, brave survivor of exactly this kind of police conduct. Thank you both.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.